Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Now, those of you who haven't been stuck or enjoying yourselves on a remote Pacific island for the last month or 2 months or so even, have probably seen trailers and imagery from the film 300, which goes into pretty wide distribution coming up very soon on March 9th. The film actually saw its premiere at the Berlin Film Festival back on February 14th and apparently received a rousing standing ovation from the audience in attendance that night. The film is directed by Zack Snyder, with the visual effects supervisor Chris Watts and visual effects art director Grant Freckleton on the film. Our podcast this week is actually with director Jeremy Hunt, founder of Screaming Death Monkey. Now, of course, Jeremy Hunt was the co-director and producer of, I think, one of the first real internet viral films, the film 405. It's especially one of the first visual effects-laden viral films, and it really received huge attention by the general public, as well as members of the film industry and critics and so forth, and it was really groundbreaking from that standpoint. Screaming Death Monkey worked on the painterly sequences in 300 and utilized a variety of technology and software, including things like Lightwave, Inferno, and Ion's Digital Fusion. Be sure to check out our online article, which has imagery created by Screaming Death Monkey for the film. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and join our interview that Mike Seymour had with Jeremy Hunt.
Thanks, John. And Jeremy, thanks very much for talking to us.
No problem. Glad to do it.
So, first of all, before we get into 300, which is an outstanding project, I've just got to discuss the origins of the company.
Sure.
First of all, greatest name for a visual effects house in ages.
Well, thank you so much. It's one of those things, people either love it or hate it, but nobody's forgotten it so far, so hopefully that's going to continue. A lot of people ask where it came from. It's kind of hard to say. It started as just a personal website of mine that I just wanted kind of an unusual name, just kind of, you know, jot down my rants and post my photographs and whatever. And when it came time to start a new business, everything was already in place as far as domain registrations and incorporations and all that stuff. So it was just a matter of filling out a few pieces of paperwork, and there we went. And, I had already designed logos and that kind of thing, so it seemed like a good fit.
Now, I guess you first hit my radar, as you did many people, with 405, which was really the grandfather of viral campaigns. It was the thing that made everybody sit up and take notice.
Yeah, yeah.
Broke kind of every record ever.
Yeah, we didn't set out to do that, but we were pleasantly surprised with the results. Yeah, it was the kind of thing in 2000 when broadband was just becoming more commonplace and more people were getting it. And the whole idea of short films was kind of taking off. There had been a couple that had some mild success before us, and we thought it was a good way of, you know, getting our name out there as a calling card, more or less, with the idea that we could use it to generate some freelance gigs. And little did we know that within, you know, literally a couple of days, we would have phone calls from Hollywood agents and lawyers and wanting to set up meetings with heads of studios. And it was a whirlwind. And then it went on to become, you know, one of, if not the most downloaded short films in the history of the internet. And, you know, we still, every once in a while, something pops up. A couple years ago, Yahoo named it one of the top 100 most important things to happen on the internet in the first 10 years. And it was just things like that we never set out to do that caught us off guard and just make us, you know, really humble and appreciative of the power of the internet, and that so many people kind of took notice and enjoyed our work.
I'm sure you're sick of talking about it, but can you just give me some context of where you guys were at professionally? Sure. When you did 405?
Sure. I made 405 with my partner at the time, Bruce Brannett. We were both working at a small boutique company in Santa Monica, California, where we primarily worked on Star Trek. At the time, we were working on Star Trek Voyager as well as Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And, you know, that was a dream gig, especially for me, because I came out of film school. I knew nothing about, you know, computer-generated visual effects. Begged this guy, the owner, for an internship, and ended up working my way up to a senior artist.
And which company was that?
There's a company called Digital Muse. They're no longer in business. But,
and Dan Curry was the visual effects supervisor on Star Trek, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, worked with Dan Curry a lot, worked with Ron Moore a lot. And like I said, it was a dream gig. It was a great show. It was high profile. You know, I ended up getting 2 Emmy nominations as a result of my work on that show. So it was a phenomenal experience, and I learned so much. But it got to a point where, like anything that you do over and over and over, it becomes kind of stifling in a way, because Star Trek has a very specific universe and they have very specific rules. And, you know, Bruce and I would come up with ideas and things that we'd love to have tried out. And, you know, we were told from the beginning that no, that would never get approval or whatnot. So we got to a point where we were tired of fulfilling other people's vision, and we wanted to fulfill our own vision. We wanted to make our own projects. So, for about a year, we had been looking for something to do, and we had a couple ideas, and they just never kind of came to fruition. And one day, Bruce showed me a test he had done of a freeway environment that he built when he was coming down from visiting a friend in Valencia. He had just kind of stuck his digital camera out the roof of his car and took a bunch of photographs and used those photographs to build this rudimentary 3D environment. And it was convincing enough, after having spent just a couple hours on it, that we thought we could make something very convincing. So that evolved into, you know, throwing a couple stock models that we had laying around and just to test the environment. And that evolved into landing a jet. And then from that point, you know, we said, well, we need a story. And so,
because I want to ask you about that, because both Ron Moore in particular is a brilliant storyteller, and Dan Curry, both, you know, Dan's work is excellent and very story motivated. I was wondering, you must have been in a culture where effects were story driven, and I'm wondering how much that influenced you, because the thing about 405 is it did have a start, a middle, and an end. It wasn't just a technical exercise for its own sake.
Well, that is where Bruce and I both come from. We're both products of Spielberg and Lucas. You know, those were the guys who inspired us when we were kids and really kind of got us into wanting to do what we do. And if you look at both of those guys, they use visual effects heavily, but they don't make visual effects movies. I mean, Lucas, there's arguments now, but when they first started, they were films and they used visual effects in order to enable them to tell these fantastical stories that they wanted to tell.
Absolutely.
They weren't simply effects for effect's sake. And Bruce and I always approached our idea of storytelling from the same way. We knew that it had to have a story. If it didn't have a story, who cares? You know, yeah, wow, you can blow up a plane, or you can, you know, make a plane land on the freeway. But if there's no compelling reason as why you want to watch that, it just, like you said, it becomes just a technical exercise. And then you're only talking to guys that are into the technical aspects of it, which is cool, but we wanted to reach a broader audience. So we knew that we had to have a story. And so we knew that we needed to have this, like you said, a beginning, middle, and end, and it had to have an arc. And I went to film school, so that was my background. I was trained in, you know, in effectively telling stories on the screen. And so I sat down, and I, you know, within 2 hours, I came up with the idea of the cliched old lady driving, you know.
Because I was going to say that was the thing that was really funny for me, is when I showed that, you know, it went around the internet. Obviously, I was part of that community and got it fairly early. And so I'd show it to somebody who was a visual effects artist, that, of course, the primary motivation, I guess, was to say, wow, look what you can do and look what these guys have done. And yet the thing we always ended up talking about was the little old lady. Do you know what I mean? Like it was, that's one of the things that was incredibly charming about it. And yet, you know, we're the geeks that were looking at it primarily from a technical point of view. So,
well, that's really nice to hear. You know, every time I hear someone pay a compliment to 405 like that, it makes me feel good. It's not something that I ever get tired of hearing, because I mean, we really put a lot of energy into making sure that it was a tight little package, that it was interesting, that it had suspense, that it had drama, that right when, you know, you don't think it can get any bigger, it gets released with a little laugh, and, you know, and then there's this kind of gag at the end, and it all is this nice package. And I mean, honestly, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was years of trying to find the right thing, but the idea of it all came together very, very quickly. From deciding to do it, to coming up with the story, to deciding to film it was a Thursday. It was just like basically one day, and we were out shooting that Saturday.
And so it must be, in the same respect, it must be really satisfying to work on 300, because this is a project that obviously the writer, the storyteller, has a huge influence on the project. This is not a studio film that's been ripped away from the hands of the writer and hacked by 50,000 committees. Tell us about 300, because I do want to get onto that, and also because I do believe that it's the story of that film that's one of the most compelling aspects about it as well.
Well, the story, I mean, the story is one of the most amazing stories. I mean, I remember reading about the story when I was a little kid, and there's a reason that the story is told, is analyzed and discussed in every single military academy in the world. It is such an amazing idea, and the fact that you can trace, you know, our Western civilization to this one battle is amazing. And then couple that with Frank Miller, who is this amazing visual storyteller, and you know, they obviously deviated from the specific, you know, realism of the story, but the core ideas are there, the core story is there. And then take Zach, who is this amazing director, and I think he's gonna, I mean, obviously this film, I've seen it a couple times and it's blown me away, and I wouldn't say that if I wasn't a fan of it. I'm not saying that just because I worked on it, but it's really an amazing film and he's done an amazing job. And so couple those three elements, and then like you said, there seems to have been and I don't know how this went down, but there seems to have been a level of trust saying, you know, we trust you to make this amazing film and it's going to look cool. It's going to be cool. And apparently the audience reviews are through the roof, and I think it's going to be a huge hit.
So tell
and it's
me,
not compromised.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, I think obviously for those people that aren't quite up to speed yet, it's a graphical novel film thing in the way that the earlier Frank Miller, God, I got a mental blank, Sin City, thank you, Sin City was, of completely different subject matter, in no way or shape a sequel, but it still has that graphical novel feel to it. Tell us about the actual filmmaking process, because it was a heavily green screen project.
Yeah, it was all shot on green screen. I think that the final breakdown was about 80% green screen and 20% blue screen, just simply for technical and lighting reasons. I'm sorry, opposite, 80% blue screen, 20% green screen. And like Sin City, it had that same graphical approach. I would say Sin City is a much more graphical look and feel, where 300 is a much more painterly look and feel. The kind of the mantra that was hammered down our throats from early on was 60% photoreal, 40% watercolors. And everything was shot in mind with the idea that there would be this heavy, what they call the crush, put on afterwards, where the dark levels are really brought down into the super saturated blacks, and the highlights are laid back on top. So you get this very unique painterly look, while still being semi-photoreal. So it's an interesting experience, because as you're watching it, you kind of go back and forth. Is it painted? Is it real? It's kind of like watching a painting come to life. And Zach shot it in a way where there's so many moments of the film where it's just like you could take a snapshot of that, frame it, put it on your wall, and it would be in this, you know, amazing painting. And I think a lot of that comes from Frank's sensibilities as well, because Zach was very, very true to the graphic novel as far as emulating specific frames and shot sequences.
And Screaming Death Monkey worked on the Oracle sort of character sequence. Can you tell me about that in particular?
Sure. We got the opportunity to work on three scenes that happened early in the film. The main character, King Leonidas, realizes the threat to his country, and he's got to present his plan to his superiors. So he goes on this little trek to climb this mountain and seek the advice of this beautiful half-naked oracle. And she is in this persistent state of drug-induced euphoria. So the challenge there was, I mean, like I said, it was all shot on green screen and blue screen, and the theory was if anything is being touched by the character, they wanted it to be practical. So they actually built these kind of rocky outcropping sets, shot it on a blue screen stage, and so we would do set extensions of the mountain, these kind of big painterly matte paintings of the skies and the distant landscape. And then once he gets to the top of this this mountain, there's this kind of god pullout where we had to do this huge set extension and continue the digital camera move to reveal this temple area that he's been on his way to. Once we get in there, he seeks the advice of this oracle. And the whole idea there that we were presented with was she has to interact with this smoke in a way that the smoke almost becomes a character.
I was going to comment on that because there's an ethereal aspect to it. It's the technical, as you're describing, but actually just the animation and the way that she interacts with that smoke is extraordinary. I've got put on the website an image, a high-res frame of that, but tell me how you actually approach that technically.
That was a really, really interesting sequence to work on because they shot it wet for dry. So they took the actress, they put her in a big tank, and cranked up the frame rate to like 150, 200 frames a second, and just had her undulate and dance around and kind of fall back. And from there, Zach was able to build these really intricate speed ramps that would highlight her movement. So she would go from normal speed to super slow-mo, back to normal, back to kind of slow-mo. And so from there, because obviously it was all blue screen underwater, we had to build a recreation of the set, the matte painting behind her, animate all the clouds. And then the real challenge was getting the smoke look. The R&D process on that was pretty extensive because we knew that it needed to do specific things. It needed to travel in specific ways, but it still had to have the smoky quality. So we went back and forth from using, you know, Maya particles to practical smoke. We did a lot of filmed smoke elements. And what we ended up with was using Lightwave's cloth simulations and morphing those cloth simulations through a bone chain. And once we had the kind of the look of the smoke, we were able to use the bones and the morphing techniques to get it into the positions that we needed to be in. And then a lot of shading and rendering and spitting out tons of elements and then combining them all again in Digital Fusion and adding that with a lot of film grain and glows and warps and all kinds of stuff, ended up with the smoke we ultimately were
happy with. What was the underwater footage shot on? What was the...
It was shot... it was all shot on film.
And so it was like 35 at a fairly low grain stock? Because I'm normally underwater...
35, and it was actually a very high grain stock.
Oh, really?
I haven't heard a specific story as to why they used the film stock they used. One, I think they wanted a very grainy look, and two, they needed it for budgetary concerns because they knew they were going to be shooting a lot of low light stuff. So it ended up being really grainy, which, as your audience knows, I'm sure that compounds a lot of issues as far as tracking and matching the grain later, pulling screens. It was a challenge, but ultimately it makes for a really, really cool look.
What were you pulling the keys in? Because that would have been a hard key.
Yeah, primarily we used Discrete's Inferno. Wayne Shepherd, who owns a company called At The Post, who we work with pretty much on every project we do, he kind of headed the compositing side of it, and he was able to pull some miracles off, really. because once you see the film, she's the Oracle is wearing this like Gaussian cloth that is pretty much transparent. So couple that with the film grain and you know, the underwater aspects of bubbles and all kinds of stuff in the water, made for a challenge, but it ultimately worked out and looks really, really pretty.
It does. And was that something that you would have worked closely with the art director? Is it Grant?
Grant Freckleton. Absolutely. Which was another really nice thing about this film, because Zach knew that it was going to have the specific style, and it was definitely nice going into a film with a specific vision, because as a visual effects artist, one of the hardest things that we have to do is interpret other people's ideas of what something is supposed to look like, especially on a project like this where it's kind of open to your interpretation. It's so stylized that it can be difficult. But what they were able to provide to us was specific keyframes from each sequence. So for every scene, we would get one or two pretty much done shots that Grant would do in Photoshop, which would give us the placement of the horizon lines, the overall color palette, the lighting, just the general feel of everything. So we were able to use that as a really, really strong starting point to match the entire sequence to.
Well, it does look magnificent. And so tell me, what's on the agenda at the moment for Screaming Death Monkey? Are you allowed to ask what's next?
Sure. Yeah, we're actually looking to start a couple of fairly sizable music videos. I've had the opportunity to direct and produce some stuff in the past, and just kind of out of the blue, we've gotten a couple projects on the plate and looking to shoot those in March. So hopefully that'll start happening. Also, one of the things, speaking of 405, that has been near and dear to my heart is obviously kind of producing my own content. And with the success of 405, I've been a little gun shy because it's kind of like, okay, well, I've done that. How can I possibly top it? There's going to be way too much expectation.
The second album phenomenon.
Exactly. So I've decided just to forget trying to match 405, and I'm just going to go out and produce something. And I've got this, I think, pretty amazing idea. It's very different from 405. It's very, it's hard to describe. I'll have to just kind of wait to see it. But hopefully that project is going to get going in the next couple of months, and once we get funding. And again, it's a short film. It's going to be between 10 and 12 minutes, but very elaborate, all visual effects. But again, it's going to have a beginning, middle, and end, because what's the point otherwise?
So where are you guys based, and where can people find out more about Screaming Death Monkey?
Sure. We have a website, screamingdeathmonkey.com, all one word. And we are in Venice, California, right by the beach.
Excellent. Well, look, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. I get to do a lot of these things, but I must say, I was looking forward to this one because 405 was just such fun, and I love what you guys did, and it was obviously a great story. And then on top of that, 300 being such an epic film and such a highly anticipated one, it's great to drill down on one particular shot and hear how you got around some of the issues. So thanks for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Jeremy, for taking the time to speak with us this week. Once again, our online article has imagery that they worked on for the film, so be sure to check that out. Well, that's it for this week at Effects Guide. For my co-founders, Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.